Now, we were discussing last time a little bit about this notion of the re-spiritualization of matter and how there's matter and spirit, but really there's only spirit. And so I mentioned before, I mentioned to you that some people want to take this in a way that would say that there is actually no material energy. I think Porcel raised the question about how can there be something unconscious coming from Krishna. And people have looked at these passages like the ones we looked at yesterday, 424 and the stuff in this chapter. And I know devotees who have speculated that really there's only Krishna and jivas. When it says that everything is really spirit, that means everything is really only, in other words, the category of the external potency really doesn't exist fundamentally. That is to say, the Brahma Jyoti is nothing but a lot of jivas packed in there together. And that matter, well, like, take this, the matter has ultimate constituents, say, this blackboard, this slate here, is really the ultimate constituents, the atoms, say, are really jivas, because it says there's a jiva inside every atom. So what an atom really is a jiva, but a jiva in deep ignorance. So really, all you really have are jivas, but some of them are ignorant. And so the ignorance of the jiva, what's that jiva is ignorance, appears to us as matter. But there really isn't matter. This is the way they want to understand this. Everything is really spirit. But the reason why I don't accept that is there are such clear statements in the Shastra everywhere that there's different kinds of energy, including his separated earth, air, fire, water, ether, and not just in that Bhagavad Gita verse, but Bhagavatam, there's whole sections about how there's first of all the Mahatattva, how the Mahatattva in ignorance evolves the elements, and the Mahatattva in passion involves the senses, and so on. How the whole material universe evolves. And everywhere it's described as matter. And nowhere do I see this simple, elegant explanation that there's only jivas really stated anywhere. I mean, if it were true, Prabhupada or Vyasadeva could have said it just as simply as anybody else, and they don't say it. So I will have to say that that's a speculation. And I wrote a doctoral dissertation on a philosopher, Hartshorne, who basically believes that, a kind of pluralistic idealism. There isn't any matter. Everything is little minds. And what you see when you see matter is a bunch of low-grade minds, like a bunch of soldiers going in order. You know, they don't have very much freedom, and so they just march across. But they're really little living entities, so to speak. I don't see that philosophy there. As to the question of how something conscious can produce matter, it's clear that happens. Just for example, Prabhupada gave the example of a living body producing dead fingernails or hair, which is not conscious. He gives the example of a lemon tree producing lemon juice, or citric acid. And he says, both life and matter come from life. Remember, he used that slogan, life comes from matter is the materialist slogan. Prabhupada said, life comes from life. And then he said, both matter and life come from life. So it's clear, first of all, that life can produce matter. And how does he do that? A lot of times we see if you take the principle that everything comes from Krishna and he doesn't give what he hasn't got, so he hasn't got unconsciousness, so how can he produce it? But unconsciousness is a negation. It's the absence of something. Like, for example, Krishna is eternal, but he creates a world where things are temporary. Well, that means he gives things what Prabhupada calls partial eternality. He has full being, which is being without beginning and end. So in the material world, there's partial being, partial knowledge, partial bliss. See, so he can give deficiencies. So somehow or other, he's got an energy, this material energy, which always remains separate from him. Even when it's all wound up inside of him, it never quite merges. And then it's described in Bhagavatam by the example of the spider that produces out of its own body the substance of its web. It sits on its web as though it's something separate and then can take it back up into itself. And this way, and that web, as material nature, it's matter. And so its unconsciousness is just the absence of a certain feature of Krishna. It's not actually something positive. So certainly there can be deficiencies, like there can be deficiencies in existence, deficiencies in knowledge, deficiencies in bliss. And that way, that's how that's produced. That's the best account I can give of that understanding. If somebody has got a better idea, that's listen to it, but that's the best I can figure it out. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, we want to finish this chapter up. So we've had a pretty complete discussion about this alchemical process of transmuting matter to spirit. Main thing is not even if you can't figure it out exactly philosophically. The point is you know how to do it. It's like quantum mechanics. Nobody can figure out how it works theoretically, but they know they get good predictions out of it, so they accept it. In the same way, we can actually employ everything in the service of the Lord and then experience that everything is Brahman. So you can actually experience that. Everything is actually Brahman. Let's see, we discussed the tree of work, right? The banyan tree. We discussed how jnana and karma are subordinate to bhakti. Oh, here we are, text 36. Now here Narada Muni is talking about, again we go back to this, remember we discussed these two ways of complete engagement. One is just completely hearing and chanting and doing nothing else, like the Bhakti Vedantas that Narad Muni had association. Or the other is to engage in the service of the Lord, whatever activity one is attracted to or whatever one has an attraction for. And those are two ways. So here he says, while performing duties according to the order of Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one constantly remembers him, his name, and his qualities. So that's what goes along with working for Krishna or doing our duties for Krishna, is that one remembers Krishna. You'll notice here when it talks about performing duties, when we're talking about performing duties in the Vedic context, it always goes down to ritualistic performances. And you know, one meaning of the word karma is simply activities of sacrifice. That's also a narrow definition of karma. So that's why Prabhupada in the purport says, according to Vedic rites, even in the worship of some demigods like Indra, Brahma, Saraswati, and Ganesh, the system is that in all circumstances the representation of Vishnu must be there as the Yajneshwara, or the controlling power of such sacrifices. So if you're performing a fruitive activity in the Karmakanda section of the Vedas in the form of a sacrifice, and you're actually sacrificing, in the process of sacrifice, you're worshiping Indra, Brahma, Saraswati, Ganesh, still the procedure calls for the presence of Krishna. Like when we do a fire sacrifice, we have what we call Shripat, that's Krishna. As the Yajneshwara, the Lord of the sacrifice. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, therefore, even in these fruitive activities, there's a tinge of bhakti. Because Krishna has to be worshipped as a matter of course. Or Vishnu has to be worshipped as a matter of course. And therefore, people make spiritual advancement. It is recommended that a particular demigod be worshipped for a particular purpose, but still the presence of Vishnu is compulsory in order to make the function proper. So this is an illustration. When we read a purport, we say, why does Prabhupada say this? Because he's illustrating the point. When performing duties according to the order of Sri Krishna, one constantly remembers him. So here's an example that you have to remember him. You perform even fruitive activities according to Vedic orders, you're forced to remember Krishna. It says, apart from Vedic duties, then the result must be given. And then Prabhupada here in the purport stresses something which we have not much discussed in ISKCON. The rule that our monetary income, not less than 50%, must be spent to carry out the order of Lord Krishna. As devotees are becoming householders and making money, it's time to start thinking about that one. But it says 50%. Well, net or gross? Before or after taxes? What's 50%? There was somebody who wrote an article for Back to Godhead magazine that the way he figured 50% left, you know, whatever you had left over after you spent everything else, 50% of your, you know, surplus. But I don't think that's right. But anyway, the idea is that principally you're working for Krishna. I mean, just get the mood is that whatever I'm doing, I'm earning money. That's the fruit of my work. I'm doing this work in order to earn money. So I have to work for Krishna. So that means the most of what I earn is used in Krishna's service. And so that's why he says at least half. And the rest, somehow or other, I keep body, soul together, take care of the mundane things, arrange for a trip to the Grand Canyon, whatever. But 50% for the service of Krishna. That's his idea of how to engage. Here's an interesting sentence. Again, he says this over and over and over again, this 50% business. We'd do well if people tithe like the Mormon church. Tithe means 10%. But that's why they're so rich. Actually, people give actually 10% religiously. I suspect that means 10% of the gross, which may be about the same as 50% of the net. I don't know. Somebody has to sit down and figure this out. Anyway, the idea is not to see how much you can get away with, you know, but the idea is to really serve Krishna. That's what it means. And all, if you want to do your work and constantly remember Krishna, then this is how it has to be done. He says, in this fallen age of quarrel and dissension, if only the leading and wealthy persons of society agree to spend 50% of their income in the service of the Lord, as it is taught by Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then there is absolute certainty of converting this hell of pandemonium into the transcendental abode of the Lord. Huh? Who knows where the word pandemonium comes from? Hey, I know you would know.
Milton invented the word. It's the place where when the angels who rebelled against him in heaven were thrown out of heaven, they were tossed out of heaven, but there was nowhere for them to go because nothing had been created, so they just fell wherever they were in heaven. And they ended up in this fiery lake, which is a place that God... So they're floating around in there, and they said, well, there's no land. So the demons got together, and all the demons...
Means all the demons, right? Pan demon.
And they made this huge palace, and so now they had a place to go. And so pandemonium is literally just means all the demons. It's the place where all the demons
live. Nice, huh?
Milton invented the word, but yeah. It's just
great
Latin.
Well, you know, Prabhupada's education, I'm sure he read Milton, they had to read it. Yeah. So this hell of a pandemonium, he's thinking of this. It's really far out. Yeah. It'd be interesting to trace those traditions back, you know. The same thing with Dante's Inferno. That's definitely, you know, that you don't see any of that stuff in the Christian scriptures, but you see a whole tradition around it, which sounds very much like Bhagavatam ideas. And so there's something leaked through. Okay. This is a very nice purport to this verse, actually. The only condition for successfully executing such spiritual activities is that they must be conducted under the guidance of a pure devotee who is completely free from all mundane desires, fruitive activities, and dry speculations about the nature of the Lord. No one has to discover the nature of the Lord. It is already spoken by the Lord himself in Bhagavad Gita especially, and in all other Vedic literatures generally. We have simply to accept them in toto. In toto means completely. And abide by the orders of the Lord that will guide us on the path of perfection. One can remain in his own position. No one has to change his position, especially in this age of variegated difficulties. And then he says, you just have to give up trying to become God. then Narada Muni, in text 37, he offers up a mantra, a Vedic mantra, because it begins with Om Namo Bhagavate Tubhyam. So this is an Om Namo. When you see a mantra beginning with Om, that's especially a Shruti or Vedic mantra. Om Namo Bhagavate Tubhyam Vasudevaya Dhimahi Pradyumnaya Niruddhaya Namashankarashanaya Cha. Now, this is, turns out, is very confidential mantra here. So who are these four deities? Huh? Vasudeva, Pradyumna, Aniruddha, and Sankarsana. Who knows who these four deities are? Yeah. Yeah. The first quadrantial expansion, Brahman calls it. Right. After Lord Krishna expands, then there's Shankarshan. And then there's this fourfold expansion. Vasudev, Pradyumna, Aniruddha, Shankarshan. It goes by the name. Chatur Vyuha. Chatur Vyuha. You know, I'm not actually sure. I never looked it up. I don't know for sure. Chatur is four. Vyuha means, I don't know, arrangement? Yeah. Display, yeah. This Chatur Vyuha, this worship of these four deities, is associated historically with the Pancharatrika tradition. That name comes up later on, huh? There is a tradition from South India that's called Pancharatrika, from which we get the, Prabhupada says, the most authorized rules for deity worship. Because you will hear this Pancharatrika Vidhi, as opposed to Bhagavat Vidhi. Vidhi means a system of regular principles. Pancharatrika refers to the rules for the worship of deities, temple worship. Whereas Bhagavad Vidhi deals with the hearing and chanting of the glories of Krishna. And Prabhupada said that these two Vidhis are like the two rails of the track on which the train of our movement runs. This Pancharatrika Vidhi and Bhagavata Vidhi. What Narada Muni is mostly teaching here is, in fact, Bhagavad Vidhi. But when he invokes the four deities of the Chaturvyuha, we can also see that he is implicitly making a reference to the Pancharatrika Vidhi. So here he just said, this is like a mantra that he chants by which his own realization is conveyed. And there was earlier on in the Bhagavatam the question, he says, in the last paragraph, now the question which was raised by the great Rishi headed by Shonaka regarding the confidential part of Sutta's achievement is given here. There was a question to Sutta. About his confidential knowledge. Let's see. I know the word shows up in the word for word, Guyam, but it doesn't show up in the translation. Let me see. Forgot to write down the number. See, the sages gathered together to at Naimisharanya, and they put Sutta Goswami on the Vyasasana, and they asked him a series of questions. And this is the answer, actually, to one of the questions when he quotes Narada Muni. And they ask him what he had confidentially learned. And I'm sorry, I did forgot to. I can't find it. Anyway, this is the answer. It's interesting because we see that although Krishna is not mentioned, Prabhupada says in the purport that actually Krishna is indicated because he calls these the four aides-de-camps to Krishna. You know, like a general will have four colonels who are his aides-de-camps, run messages and do various things for him, called an aide-de-camp. So these are the four aides-de-camps. So he says, is addressed to the four deities or the Lord with his plenary expansions. The central figure is Lord Sri Krishna because the plenary portions are his aides-de-camps. The most confidential part of the instructions that one always chant to remember the glories of Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, along with his different plenary portions, expanded as Vasudev, Shankarshan, Prajumna, and Aniruddha. That's what he says. Oh yeah, here it is. And because you are submissive, your spiritual masters have endowed you with all the favors bestowed upon a gentle disciple. Therefore, you can tell us all that you have scientifically learned from them. This is 118. But in the Sanskrit, you see, bruya snigdasya shishyasya, gaurava guyam apyuta. Guyam means secret. Everything that you have learned that is confidential. That's what they want to hear. So that's where the guyam comes in. Now, somehow or other, Prabhupada didn't put it in the translation. But here, later on, when he regards the confidential part of Sutta's achievement, you have to go back and look and see that the word guyam is there. So we discussed that word guyam, aguyatamam, secret or most secret. So here he was learning these confidential, which Prabhupada here translates as scientific. That's because sometimes he uses scientific as a translation for vijnana, which means realized knowledge as opposed to jnana. Or vijnana means knowledge of Krishna opposed to jnana, which is knowledge of impersonal Brahman. That's what he happens to do in this particular thing. But that's what it refers to. Thus, he is the actual seer who worships in the form of transcendental sound representation the Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu, who has no material form. Well, that was an example of a mantra of worshiping the Lord in the form of sound. And here, Prabhupada discusses how Krishna is available in sound. Any object which has existence in itself, and which is not part of an object, other object, has these name, form, qualities, and activities. Any self-substantial entity. So Krishna has name, form, qualities, and activities. If something is missing one of these, then we can understand it's part or belongs to some other object. Just like the impersonal Brahman has no form, so it's actually, we understand it's part of Krishna and not an independent entity. So we begin with Krishna's name. We just chant Krishna's name. And if the chanting of Krishna's name is carried out successfully, then we will also apprehend his form. In this sequence, first there'll be realization of the name, then realization of the form, then realization of the qualities of Krishna, and then realization of the activities of Krishna. One by one in sequence, these become directly revealed to the chanter of the name. The transcendental form of eternal bliss and knowledge can be experienced by our original spiritual senses, which can be revived by the chanting of the holy mantras or transcendental sound representations. So this is the process of reviving our original spiritual senses. When those senses are revived, then Krishna can be apprehended. That's what the mantra does. Such sound should be received from the transparent agency of the bona fide spiritual master, and the chanting may be practiced by the direction of the spiritual master. That will gradually lead us nearer to the Lord. This method of worship is recommended in the Pancharatrika system. There it is. I knew it was in here. Which is both recognized and authorized. The Pancharatrika system has the most authorized codes for transcendental devotional service. Without the help of such codes, one cannot approach the Lord, not by dry philosophical speculations. He said it's more important than the Vedanta. So the Pancharatrika, as I said, mostly it has the instructions for deity worship, but the deity worship is actually, most of deity worship is chanting of mantras, really. And in fact, it all can be done by mantra. So mantra chanting is part of the deity worship, and it goes along with it. So this is the that's why I mentioned this Pancharatrika. There's the codes of deity worship, but also all this is in there too. O Brahmana, thus by the Supreme Lord Krishna, I was endowed first with transcendental knowledge of the Lord as inculcated in the confidential parts of the Vedas. Hmm? then with spiritual opulences, and then with his intimate, loving service. So three things: confidential knowledge, then spiritual opulences, then intimate, loving services. Communion with the Lord by transmission of the transcendental sound is none different from the whole spirit, Lord Sri Krishna. So really, you're not in contact with something that's limited. When there's communion with the Lord through transcendental sound, the whole thing, the whole person, Krishna, Krishna's energies, Krishna's, everything is there. It is a completely perfect method for approaching the Lord. By such pure contact with the Lord, without offense of material conception, numbering 10, that is the offenses against the holy name. When the holy name is actually appreciated for what it is, he is. The devotee can rise above the material plane to understand the inner meaning of the Vedic literatures, including the Lord's existence in the transcendental realm. The Lord reveals his identity gradually to one who has unflinching faith both in the spiritual master and the Lord. Here he's quoting from the Svetashvatara Upanishad. A lot of times what Prabhupada's purports is they're just quotations. And the Svetashvatara Upanishad says, it comes right at the end of this Upanishad, and it says, the great souls who actually can understand this Upanishad, Katita Hyarta, all these discussions, it says the artha, the meaning, the purport of these discussions, prakashante, will be shined forth or be revealed unto that great soul who has para-bhakti, or supreme devotion unto the Lord and the spiritual master. It's not enough that you read it. It's not enough that you studied Sanskrit at Harvard. It's not enough. Nothing works, but there has to be para-bhakti. Right in the text itself. I was with a bunch of scholars, and I said, you know, you read the Upanishads, and I read the Upanishads. But when I read this text, we're both trying to understand them. This is the way to understand this text. You have to have parabhakti. You have a way to understand this text that you ignore that. I said, I don't understand it. You're understanding. But that's a fact. The text itself says if you want to understand the meaning of these words, you have to have devotion to the Lord and the same devotion to the spiritual master. Then it will shine forth. So the Prabhupada's quoting that here. So he says, after this, one chants with this unflinching faith, the devotee is endowed with mystic opulences, which are 8 in number. And above all, the devotee is accepted in the confidential entourage of the Lord and is entrusted with specific service of the Lord through the agency of the spiritual master. You make the garlands, you carry the water, whatever, in Krishna's pastimes. Narada has explained all these from his personal experience. And one can obtain all the facilities which Sri Narada obtained by perfecting the chanting process of the sound representation of the Lord. There's no bar for chanting this transcendental sound by anyone, provided it is received through Narada's representative coming down through the parampara system. What we have here in this text 39 is, this is Narada Muni's summing up of his story. Now, actually, he'll continue the story, and he's looking ahead. But this is his summary of his story. Thus, by the Supreme Lord Krishna, I was endowed first with transcendental knowledge, then with spiritual opulences, and then with his intimate, loving service. He's actually looking ahead, because the story continues in the next chapter. How his mother died of a snake bite. He wandered off by himself. He saw the Lord face to face in the super soul form. The Lord said, you won't see me again in this life. Turns out Narada Muni had a little attachment to the mode of goodness. So he only saw him that one time. And then he finally left his body and achieved a spiritual form and came out again as Brahma's son. That's all described in the next chapter. If you haven't read it, you should read it. So this is the summary of his story right here. This is how this chapter ends. First, Narada Muni gives the synopsis of his story, and then finally in text 40, he gives summary of his instructions to Vyasadeva. Please, therefore, describe the Almighty Lord's activities which you have learned by your vast knowledge of the Vedas, for that will satisfy the hankerings of great learned men and at the same time mitigate the miseries of the masses of common people who are always suffering from material pangs. Indeed, there is no way to get out of such miseries. So here he takes, here's the usual distinction, right? The high-class people and the low-class people, huh? The great learned people, vidvam, it will satisfy the vidvam, those who have actual knowledge, but at the same time, the suffering mass, common people. Because usually, you know, what satisfies the learned, you know, they're sitting down there reading Milton and Shakespeare, and while the masses are watching Roseanne Barr or whoever on television, you know. So they have two different sorts of things. So here he's suggesting that if you do this Vedic literature properly, if you do your work properly, you'll have something that will be able to satisfy both groups. And that's what he's saying. And then in the purport, Prabhupada elaborates. He takes up this thing. Again, we have to ask ourselves, why does Prabhupada talk about this? Well, he takes vidvam in the sense of meaning four types of pious people. And the others, the ardita atmana, the suffering masses, suffering because they're impious. So here he alludes to the distinction given in the Bhagavad Gita. Four classes of good men who acknowledge the authority of the Lord. Those who are in difficulty, need of money, advanced in knowledge, or inquisitive. These four groups, either they have their problems, they run into devotees, they're attracted to Krishna. And then there's the other groups, the Duskritina. Sukritina, Duskritina. Kritina means someone, a doer. Duskritina, one who does bad things. Sukritina, one who does good things. So then the bad guys, addicted to the modes of progressive fruit of work, addicted to vicious work for sense satisfaction, mudha, naradama, those who are materially advanced in knowledge, but still are completely atheistic, mayaya apakrita jnana, those who, they may have some jnana, but it's been swiped out from them by their ignorance, and then atheists, asuram bhava, asrita, they have taken shelter of the nature of asuras. Those are the four. These are in the Bhagavad Gita. So here Prabhupada says, he says, this also means, when he mentions these two groups, it means not only the, you know, the elevated, educated, highly cultured people, but also the common mass, you know, the kind that go to demolition derbies and eat out at McDonald's and all that. But also it also means not only the pious, but also the bad, the impious. Those people also we're not going to forget. Sri Narada Ji advises Vyasadeva to describe the glories of the Lord just to do good to all eight classes of men, both good and bad. For everybody is not going to be left out. Srimad Bhagavatam is therefore not meant for any particular class of men or sect. It is for the sincere soul who actually wants his own welfare and peace of mind. And that's how he finishes up the chapter. Any questions? Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the. Yeah, because that's not the deity that we worship in our Sampradaya. You go to South India, you'll see worship of Chaturvyuha. The Sri Sampradaya is associated with Vishnu worship. Yeah, we do. The form of deity worship that we follow is based on Pancharatrika standards. Yeah, it is. Because it comes into our Sampradaya through Gopal Bhatta Goswami, who is actually a South Indian. And so that's how our rules and regulations are there. This Pancharatrika Vidhi. Yeah.
What are the eight spiritual
audiences? The eight mystic yoga powers, Laghima, Anima, Prapti, and so on. You know what those are?
And so when a devotee they automatically.
Yeah, says you have them. But Prabhupada said is not interested in showing off. I mean, either you're going to spread Krishna consciousness or you're going to do circus tricks, right? No, but you can make money doing circus tricks and people will come and gawk. But you'll find out that atmosphere created by this is not conducive for actually preaching Krishna consciousness. So the devotees who are capable of doing these things, they don't do them. Any other questions? Well, let's go over a few things, yeah? Yeah, well, yeah, that's part of that system. There's a whole group of texts that are called Pancharatrika texts.
Probably five.
I asked somebody, it means five, having to do with five nights. And I asked some scholar how it got that name, and he was not clear. It has to do with. But they're traditionally called Pancharatrika text. I'm trying to remember that there's a name. It's almost on the tip of my tongue. Agamas. The Pancharatrika texts are often called Agamas. And they're all devotional texts. There's a whole bunch of them in South India. And it's kind of a supplementary Vedic text. It's a system that he says is more important, is more practical now than Vedanta. But I don't know anything more about it than really what I read in Prabhupada. And that this worship, especially the worship of the Chaturvyuha, is associated with it. Or the doctrine about the Chaturvyuhas. I mean, I don't know about the deity worship. I should take that back. I don't know about the deity worship, But the teachings about these Chaturvyuha expansions is found in the Pancharatrika tradition, mostly developed and expanded. Okay. So now let's have a little review of past material, huh? Want to do that? So what are the who can remember what the main mistakes of Vyasadeva are, according to, we don't say he made mistakes, but according to Narada Muni. You want to name one? He didn't glorify Krishna enough. What else did he do? Yeah, how do you encourage sense gratification? Yeah, he was pretty specific about it, actually. In the name of religion, he says, you have encouraged sense gratification in the name of religion. Right. Yeah?
He also encouraged demigod worship.
Yep. You mentioned that too. Anything else? Yeah?
He was identifying himself with
Yeah, well, let's go back to that, because he starts off and says, have you, you know, are you satisfied by identifying yourself with the body and the mind? And it's a little unclear how that relates to the rest of the discussion. Was he really in Maya? But if you look at the purport to text 5, the answer is given. So that's just a kind of a general way of saying that he had done something other than glorify Krishna. Because look at text 5. In this material world, everyone is engrossed with the idea of identifying the body or the mind with the self. As such, all knowledge disseminated in the material world is related either with the body or with the mind, and that is the root cause of all despondencies. So what he says is, you know, just by narrating this stuff, the Karmakanda, Gyanakanda section of the Vedas, by putting this stuff down, it's either put you into Maya or makes me think you're in Maya, because that stuff is only enjoyed and propagated by people who are identifying with the body and the mind. Now, the Karmakanda, you identify with the gross body. Gyanakanda, you identify with the mind. So that's the answer to that. I meant to mention that before. Yeah?
Is it only in Kali Yuga that this system doesn't work with Karmakanda, Gyanakanda, in other ages?
In other ages, it's possible it's a little easier to progress upwards. But in Kali Yuga, like Karmakanda, nobody can follow the regulation. Anybody here knows anything about Judaism, the commandments of the Torah? You know how many there are? 600 and some commandments of the Torah. I forgot the number, 633. There's injunctions that, you know, if you are a real Jew, then to lead a pious life, you have. There's an example of Orthodox Judaism, of a Karmakanda religion. There's not a thing you can do which isn't hedged with rules and regulations. You know? Except Vedic is even more. So there's 630 some odd commandments of the Torah you have to follow. Now, I know a woman in Krishna consciousness whose grandfather was a very observant Orthodox Jew. She asked Srila Prabhupada, what happens to my grandfather if he actually followed all these commandments of the Torah? Which, by the way, allows for meat eating and all this other stuff. You know that. But, you know, it's a whole rituals you have to go through. She said, what happened? And Prabhupada told her, he went to the heavenly planets. But if you go to Israel or any place and you find out these, you really find out who's actually following the commandments of the Torah like that, you won't see. It's very, very difficult. And in fact, the rabbis are busy writing in exceptions all the time. Well, you can't do this, so you can do this. You can't do that, you can do that. You can exception for this, exception for that. So it's not, it's just, no, even the Karmakanda section of the Veda is not practical. The Gyanakanda is even harder. So, it's not possible in this day and age. Another thing that he says, Prabhupada said, he should not have compiled any Puranas other than Srimad Bhagavatam. So if you're attracted to reading the Garuda Purana to find all about ghosts, that's the ghost Purana. I've heard tell, I haven't read it myself. Somebody sat in an Indian embassy somewhere, or consulate, with the Garuda Purana, told me they read the whole thing, all the different ghosts. And anyway, Prabhupada says shouldn't have been done. Vyasadev talks about the compromising spirit. I mean, Narada Muni says your compromising spirit. What specifically was he referring to when he talked about his compromising spirit? Yeah? Yeah, and what did he put in the Mahabharata?
Only a few verses compared to the other verses.
Well, if you look at the purport, Prabhupada specifically complains about politics, economics, philanthropic activity. You know, it's just the Mahabharata is full of mundane activities. And that's what he called his compromising spirit. Huh? No, this that he described all these mundane activities so attractively, and that a certain class of people are going to be much more interested in that. Just like when they did the Mahabharata on television, you know, the Bhagavad Gita was skipped over really fast. Everybody wants to get to the war. When's the good part going to come? It's just like children, you know. When's the good part going to come? What is the problem with demigod worship according to Prabhupada? And there are lots of problems, but Prabhupada mentions one in particular. Huh? Yeah, leads to a conception of pantheism. Uh-huh. Now, Narada Muni tells us that that we really shouldn't... Oh, we're running out of time, aren't we? Last question. Narada Muni tells us that we... anyone who, even if he takes to the path of devotional service and falls down, he really isn't the loser. Why is that? Luke?
Because not being from a devotee, even Krishna has taken care of his life.
Yeah.
Not subject to same reactions.
Yeah, so even after he leaves, he says, how does he put it? Does anybody remember exactly how he put it?
He doesn't suffer the ordinary course of...
Yeah. He doesn't undergo the ordinary course of fruitive reactions. That's right. He's especially being rectified by Krishna. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. I enjoyed teaching you greatly. Hare Krishna.